From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. One carbon, one oxygen. Carbon monoxide, odorless, colorless, and fatal to humans at high levels. But scientists are beginning to discover that used in moderation, there may be health benefits. Among those potential benefits, lessening the residual effects of heart attack and stroke, and aiding in tissue recovery after organ transplants. One of the sources for these medical breakthroughs, deep-diving sea mammals, elephant seals, those creatures with the large proboscis can weigh up to 4.5 tons, and they can stay underwater for up to 2 hours. Only Cuvier-beaked whales and sperm whales edge out this animal's capacity for holding its breath. Elephant seals and Weddell seals are the only animals scientists know of that have elevated levels of carbon monoxide in their bodies. One of the questions scientists are asking is whether carbon monoxide serves as a protective agent for these animals during these deep dives, shutting off oxygen to non-essential organs. They're also looking at what other animals might have higher levels of CO. Comparative physiologist Michael Tift is an assistant professor in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He recently won a $1 million grant from the National Science Foundation to answer some of these questions and potentially apply the answers to medicine. Michael Tift, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about deep diving sea mammals? If you have a question for Professor Tift, you can call us during the live Wednesday discussion at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. So we'll get to this carbon monoxide paradox in just a second. But first, tell us what your first in-person encounter with an elephant seal was like.
My first in-person encounter was back in 2008. It was during an internship that I had with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, and I spent 3 months living on San Miguel Island, which was a tiny little island right off the coast of Los Angeles. And during that time I was out there, we were counting all different sorts of species, and we finally were counting them from afar, and then at one point we went down on the beach to do certain surveys, and I finally got face-to-face with a large elephant seal. So that was an amazing experience to come face-to-face with an animal that is several tons.
So this animal at this moment was not tranquilized?
That's correct, yeah. So the time that I ran into them, it was a big male elephant seal, so one of the largest. But it was during the summer months where they're molting. They actually molt their entire skin and their fur kind of like a reptile. And so they weren't really...
These are mammals, though.
Yeah, so they shed their skin and their fur. It's pretty unique. And at that time, when they're molting during the summer months, they're not really fighting, so they're not, you know, particularly aggressive. And so when I came face-to-face with him, he was just as scared of me as I was of him, so it was pretty rewarding in the end.
Did you touch him?
No, I didn't touch him at that point, no. I was still pretty scared of them at that point.
Tell us about a time that you actually did touch an untranquilized elephant seal.
So when we work with elephant seals, the safest way to collect some samples is actually to sedate the animal. And so when we start, there's permits that we have to have in order to touch the animals. And so once you have a permit to do that, then you're trained for a year or two on how to safely move around the animals, specifically during breeding season when they are aggressive. And then after that, you're slowly trained on ways to safely chemically sedate them with an injection. You can actually walk up, and they're so long, if someone's kind of in the face of the elephant seal or near the head of the elephant seal and distracting the elephant seal, you can sneak up from behind and give them a muscular injection in the rear, and it takes about 10 or 15 minutes for them to be sedated.
How long is a full-grown elephant seal?
They're over 10 feet long, so they're really long animals.
Are they the largest species of seal that there is?
Yeah, they're the largest of the seals and the sea lions. There's two subspecies of elephant seals. There's a northern elephant seal in California, and then there's a southern elephant seal down in the sub-Antarctic and down in the South American region.
And so how would these animals be dangerous to you? I mean, they look like they'd be pretty clumsy and slow-moving.
Absolutely. They... for the most part, they are clumsy and slow moving, but if they want to move fast, they can. And the large animals are so, you know, they're so big, and their mouths are large and their teeth are large. So if they were to bite you, it could be really, really dangerous, as well as if they were to perhaps trample you or something like that, it could be fatal as well.
And has that happened, to your knowledge?
I've heard of people getting bit, but I have not heard of any fatalities from working with elephant seals.
So let's get to the questions that you're trying to answer with this National Science Foundation grant. So there's this carbon monoxide paradox, and of course we just came through the other end of Hurricane Dorian, and you know, aside from some of the victims of the tornadoes, there really wasn't a lot of damage in this area. But before that, before Dorian passed through, we spent a lot of time on the air telling people not to fire up generators inside closed spaces and not to use campfire grills in their kitchens inside the house or even in the garage because of carbon monoxide, this odorless, colorless gas that you may not even know you're being poisoned from in some circumstances until it's too late. And yet you're saying carbon monoxide could have some health benefits for humans.
Yeah, that's right. So carbon monoxide, known by many as the silent killer, we know it's produced from sources such as, you know, car exhaust or cigarette smoke, and it's certainly toxic. And so this new wave of research that we're doing along with many others is showing that low to moderate doses of carbon monoxide can actually have protective effects for tissues. It actually can alleviate symptoms of inflammation and cell death. And so now many researchers are trying to find out if there's ways to deliver carbon monoxide safely at low levels, or groups are even producing drugs and pharmaceuticals that release carbon monoxide at a controlled rate in specific tissues so that the entire body isn't exposed to carbon monoxide, and you can actually expose specific tissues to carbon monoxide. And so as that research pushes forward in the clinical field, what we're discovering is there's a few wild animals that actually produce carbon monoxide at fairly high levels. And we're not really quite sure why yet, but there is some hypotheses that suggest that it could be protective for those species.
So tell us how you think it works. Elephant seals are what you're studying right now, and you also have tested Weddell seals, and you know that they have very high levels of carbon monoxide in their bodies.
Right.
So how did you figure out that that is one of the elements in allowing them to take these long and very deep dives?
So the way that I stumbled upon studying carbon monoxide was actually by chance. And it's, I think it happens quite often in science. You stumble on something by accident. And I had an analyzer that measured the amount of carbon monoxide in blood, and I was doing a separate project on elephant seals. And in these blood samples, I saw very high levels of carbon monoxide. And so that was interesting, as you can imagine. And so I went and read some more papers and was talking with my my master's advisor at the time. And we came across a paper back in the 1950s where a researcher with the last name of Pugh, P-U-G-H, went down to Antarctica to measure carbon monoxide poisoning in the men that were working down in Antarctica. And the reason was because, just as you had stated, they were using coal-burning stoves and things like that to keep warm, and they were producing lots of smoke, and there was lots of carbon monoxide in the atmosphere of the tents they were in. And so he went down to measure to see if these men were getting CO poisoning, and he brought an apparatus.
So that was
down.
A hypothesis when he went.
Yeah.
They didn't know that's why they were dying.
Yeah, he was worried about the CO poisoning just from the coal-burning stoves. And so when he got there, he had an apparatus to measure the amount of CO in the blood. And at that time, they had sled dogs to move equipment around. And to feed the sled dogs, right outside of that base, there were Weddell seals. And they would actually kill the Weddell seals and chop them up and feed them to the dogs. And so this researcher had an opportunity to get free blood samples from these Weddell seals that were being slaughtered for the dogs. And when he measured the CO in the Weddell seals just to test out his apparatus, he showed that the amount of CO in those Weddell seals was as high or higher than the cigarette smokers that were down in Antarctica. And so since then, no one has approached this topic, which is some species may have high levels of carbon monoxide and they may make it naturally. And so we focused on a similarly related species, a deep diving seal, the elephant seal.
So then your hypothesis is that when an elephant seal goes on a deep dive, that animal's ability to store oxygen, increased amounts of oxygen, and also its ability to stop oxygen flow to everything except the heart and the brain is part of why he can undertake that long, deep dive. And what does carbon monoxide do?
Yeah, so in general, deep diving mammals have the ability to store large amounts of oxygen in their body. And the two primary places that they store oxygen is in the blood and in the muscle. And so there are proteins that store and transport oxygen in the blood. It's called hemoglobin. In the muscle, it's called myoglobin. So deep diving mammals tend to have very high concentrations of these. And that's, they've evolved to have high concentrations in order to store large amounts of oxygen so they can take a lot of oxygen down to depth. Carbon monoxide is toxic because it binds to hemoglobin and myoglobin at the same sites where oxygen bind. So it can displace oxygen and basically inhibit your ability to transport oxygen in your body. So it essentially suffocates you. So ironically, breaking down hemoglobin naturally produces carbon monoxide. So CO is toxic because if you're exposed to it, it'll bind to hemoglobin to displace oxygen. But when you naturally break apart hemoglobin, you actually make a little bit of carbon monoxide. So you and me, a healthy human, will have low amounts of carbon monoxide because we naturally turn over red blood cells and break down hemoglobin.
And we're going to continue with this explanation when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline. Michael Tift, comparative physiologist from UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology, is with us today. When we come back from this break, more on the potential of carbon monoxide in medicine, both human and veterinary. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Elephant seals can dive in the ocean, stay underwater for up to 2 hours at a time, as can other marine mammals such as beaked whales. Now scientists are learning this ability might have applications in human and veterinary medicine. Comparative physiologist Michael Tift, assistant professor in UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology, is with us today to unpack this for us. You can ask your own question during the live Wednesday discussion by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. So, Michael Tift, just before we went to break, we might need to back up a little bit and start it again, but you were kind of explaining what happens with carbon monoxide in the body and how it binds to hemoglobin, mm-hmm. which essentially is why people can die from it at high levels. It suffocates you.
Right.
But how does it behave in elephant seals?
So just stepping back a minute, deep diving mammals have high concentrations of hemoglobin and myoglobin, which are the proteins in your body that transport and store oxygen. And so those molecules are essential to living as mammals because they allow you to transport oxygen to make energy, basically. And so carbon monoxide is toxic because it binds to those molecules at the same site as oxygen. So it actually competitively inhibits oxygen from binding to those and therefore essentially suffocates you. Now, what's interesting is that there are all these outside sources of carbon monoxide, like cigarette smoke and car exhaust and things like that. But we actually make carbon monoxide naturally in the body, and all animals, including plants and bacteria, make carbon monoxide naturally. And it's from breaking down those proteins naturally, like hemoglobin and myoglobin. And so the way that carbon monoxide is produced mostly in humans is because our red blood cells only live about 100 days or so, and a red blood cell is essentially a bag of hemoglobin. And when the red blood cell dies, it releases the hemoglobin, we chop up the hemoglobin, and you make a little bit of carbon monoxide. These deep diving mammals have lots of hemoglobin and lots of myoglobin in order to take down a lot of oxygen. And so because they have a lot of this hemoglobin and myoglobin, those are the source of carbon monoxide production, we think that it's the turnover of those proteins that relates to them having really high concentrations of carbon monoxide that are on level of those seen in some cigarette smokers. And so CO is toxic because it inhibits oxygen transport, but that's only when CO levels get really high in your body. Low levels of CO is actually showing anti-inflammatory effects on the body in some tissues, and it actually can prevent cell death. And the most promise for a therapeutic potential of carbon monoxide is using the gas as a way to treat conditions associated with cell death and inflammation, and one of those is organ transplantation. And so when you shut blood flow off to an organ before you transplant it, and you put an individual, and then you reperfuse that organ with blood, you can have massive amounts of inflammation and cell death. And so if you expose that tissue or that organ to CO, low amounts or moderate amounts of CO, or you even expose the person that's receiving the organ to low or moderate amounts of CO, you can actually inhibit or prevent organ transplant rejection. And so where it gets back to the elephant seal is they shut blood flow off to many organs and tissues while they're diving. They send blood to only the brain and the heart, basically, while diving. And so it's essentially equivalent or similar to an organ transplantation to all these other tissues. But they don't have any negative side effects associated with shutting blood flow off to these tissues and then reperfusing those tissues like we would. And so it's potentially the carbon monoxide, the high levels of carbon monoxide in their body, that is preventing injuries in these tissues. And that's what we're trying to find out.
You did mention, and I want to make a joke here, but I won't because it's something that you battle regularly, that cigarette smokers tend to have higher levels of carbon monoxide, but it's not a healthy thing. So tell us what you're battling, because I did not make that leap when we were first looking at this, that, oh, well, if cigarette smokers have higher levels of carbon monoxide, they must have less inflammation and they would be a better candidate for an organ transplant. There are so many other ill effects associated with cigarette smoking. So why are you battling that in the first place?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think it's really easy to make the assumption that carbon monoxide is beneficial, because many of the cases where we can show carbon monoxide is beneficial is from exposing someone to carbon monoxide or low amounts of carbon monoxide and then getting the amount of CO up in their body. But the only data set that we have of people being exposed to controlled amount of carbon monoxide are cigarette smokers. So when I tell you that an elephant seal has, you know, X amount of carbon monoxide in their body, it's easier for me to tell you that it's the equivalent to them smoking this amount of cigarettes. And then I can tell you the second thing, which is carbon monoxide might be helpful to them. And then you might say, oh, well, if it's helpful for the elephant seal, it also might be helpful for me. I've had some free divers ask, because, oh, if the carbon monoxide is helping the elephant seal dive 2 hours, maybe if I smoke cigarettes, it'll help me dive deeper. And that's just not the case. When they're showing carbon monoxide,
so you're getting these questions from people who scuba dive?
Scuba dive or free dive. Okay. Yeah, just hold their breath and dive. And so I definitely want to make it known that I'm not an advocate of cigarette smoke, and I don't think that it's beneficial for you. The protective effects that we're seeing from carbon monoxide is in laboratories where we have controlled low doses of carbon monoxide exposure. And it's the CO alone that might have some protective effects at low doses. And like you said, there's all of these negative side effects associated with cigarette smoke, such as tar, that would make it not advantageous for you if you're a diver or scuba diver.
You're listening to Coastline. Deep diving mammals such as elephant seals have an incredible ability to stay underwater for up to 2 hours at a time. And the discoveries that scientists are making about this ability and the questions they're asking may help human patients recover more quickly from heart attacks, strokes, organ transplants. My guest today is Michael Tift. He's a comparative physiologist and assistant professor in UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology. And he is answering your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. You can either call 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Elephant seals aren't the only animals that you study. You also study sea turtles and penguins. Tell us about that. And are you testing them for carbon monoxide levels?
Yeah, so as a comparative physiologist, I'm trying to look at different aspects of physiology in many different species, and that includes humans. And so some of my research has transitioned away from elephant seals, which I have done most of my work, and into different diving species such as penguins and sea turtles. And most recently, I've been working with high-altitude species, including certain high-altitude human populations. Most of my research now focuses on the ability of animals to tolerate low oxygen, including humans. And so that's why I work with deep diving animals who tolerate low oxygen from holding their breath, as well as animals at high altitude and humans at high altitude who are exposed to low oxygen. And so, yeah, we're definitely approaching right now one of our main focuses in my lab is to see who has high carbon monoxide. It's not something that people typically measure when they're looking at these animals. You know, hemoglobin and red blood cell count is something you'd look at in these animals, these deep divers. But carbon monoxide is really understudied in wildlife, and so we're trying to basically do a shotgun approach now to measure the amount of carbon monoxide in as many species as possible. So if you have blood samples from animals and you want carbon monoxide analyzed, you should get in contact with us, and we can definitely help you out.
What are some of the animals that you have tested and that you have established do have these higher levels?
So we started with the elephant seal and the Weddell seal. So those are the first. And then we've transitioned to figure out if carbon monoxide is high in other marine mammals. So we've worked with some zoological organizations to look at CO levels in killer whales, beluga whales, bottlenose dolphins, several different species of penguins, king penguins, emperor penguins, gentoo penguins, different species of sea turtles, green sea turtles.
Are you talking about animals in captivity?
Yeah, so specifically for the cetaceans, it's impossible to get a blood sample, which is how I measure carbon monoxide from a wild animal, unless that whale or dolphin is stranded on the beach. So it's these trained animals can present their fluke, and in the case of the cetaceans, and you can get a blood sample relatively easily, so we can investigate carbon monoxide.
What is a fluke?
The fluke is the tail of a whale. That's what they use to propel themselves through the water.
And so do carbon monoxide levels vary according to the activity of the animal?
So we're starting to get a grasp on that, and it's still kind of undetermined how carbon monoxide varies between species. What we're tending to see now is that if you have high hemoglobin stores, then you typically are going to have high carbon monoxide concentrations because, again, hemoglobin breakdown results in CO production, and we're constantly turning over these hemoglobin proteins. Even me and you are constantly turning over red cells and hemoglobin. And so if you have more of them, then you can produce more CO.
And ischemia, that's reducing blood flow to tissues.
Yeah. So we're finding in the research of carbon monoxide that it has great potential for alleviating bad side effects associated with ischemia. So ischemia is reduction in blood flow to a tissue. And so, like you said earlier, that's associated with conditions such as heart attacks. You reduce blood flow to the heart. Strokes reduce blood flow to the brain. And then organ transplants, you reduce blood flow to an organ while you're transplanting it. And when you reduce blood flow to an organ and you put it back into an individual and you reperfuse blood to that organ, you often have a dramatic inflammatory response that can cause damage to that tissue and to the individual. And so if you expose the individual to low amounts of carbon monoxide, it downregulates the inflammatory response so that you can actually alleviate the conditions associated with ischemia or reduced blood flow.
So is it oversimplifying then to think of it as a rush of blood is sort of like almost a violent when you're reperfusing an organ? Say, after a heart attack, mm-hmm. It would be sort of a violent way of reperfusing. And this is just sort of a gentler, gentler way of reintroducing blood flow. Is that oversimplifying it?
So simplifying it would say that when you reduce blood flow to an organ, it shuts down. It starts to shut down, and as far as metabolically speaking, everything slows down because it's not getting enough oxygen. And then if you reperfuse it too fast, then there's too much oxygen and it can't basically react fast enough. And then you actually produce these molecules called reactive oxygen species, which is associated with a condition that many know as oxidative stress. So when you have ischemia, if you have a dramatic reperfusion event to that tissue,
you have this oxidative stress. And so that's what leads to this inflammation and bad side effects. And so we're thinking that CO, if there is oxidative stress, CO can downregulate the inflammatory response that follows.
What are some of the other potential applications in human medicine? You've mentioned organ transplants, helping those. You've also mentioned recovery from heart attacks and strokes. Are there other applications?
Yeah, mostly it's associated with inflammatory disorders. So if you have any sort of kidney or lung inflammatory disorder, if you can get carbon monoxide to be upregulated, the production in those organs, you can downregulate the inflammatory response. And so that's where these pharmaceutical labs are producing these drugs to, it's really interesting. They get to these tissues and then they'll release carbon monoxide only in those tissues. So the first protective effects of carbon monoxide was about 20 or 30 years ago, where they were having patients inhale low amounts of carbon monoxide. But that exposed every single tissue to CO. And as you know, high amounts of CO is toxic and deadly. And so it was really dangerous. And so if you can control where you're releasing CO, then you can actually treat different tissues that have, say, inflammation or something like that, that CO is known to downregulate.
Where are they in terms of clinical trials? How many different pharmaceutical companies are working on applications of this? You said there are devices and pills.
Yeah, so I can't speak to the number of studies, but there are carbon monoxide releasing molecules and carbon monoxide prodrugs and even inhaled carbon monoxide clinical trials going on right now in humans, in patients, to try to treat certain illnesses.
So I understand you said with this $1 million grant from the National Science Foundation, you're taking this shotgun approach to testing different kinds of diving species, not just mammals, but reptiles as well. Have you actually tested a penguin yet?
Yeah.
And what did you find with the penguin?
So we've measured it in 5 different species of penguin, and so far it seems like the penguins with higher hemoglobin stores have higher amounts of carbon monoxide. So the king penguins and the emperor penguins are some of the deepest diving penguins, and they tend to have higher carbon monoxide levels. It's a similar story to the deepest diving seals, which are the elephant seals, have high carbon monoxide. So in general, if you're an air-breathing animal, you have more hemoglobin and more myoglobin, and that's the source of CO. So breaking those down makes more CO. So the general story is the deeper diver you are, you're evolved to store more oxygen. So you have more hemoglobin and myoglobin, and you're going to break down more hemoglobin and myoglobin, so you'll have more CO.
You're also looking at reptiles, and you mentioned green sea turtles. Are those really deep divers? And how is their story different since they're reptiles?
So green sea turtles aren't known to be particular deep divers. There is one species of sea turtle that I'm trying to get samples from, and I'm working with some colleagues from UCW, and it's the leatherback sea turtle. So that is a really deep diving sea turtle. And so we're hoping to get samples from that animal because it is the deepest diving of the sea turtles, and we expect that there might have high carbon monoxide.
And there's also a marine iguana from the Galapagos that you want to test. Have you tested this yet?
Unfortunately, no. When I was working in the Galapagos several years ago, I hadn't had this carbon monoxide hypothesis yet. But I would love to get down there and test that in all diving animals, starting with diving animals. And then where the lab's going right now, my lab is focusing on not just diving animals, but all animals that are exposed to hypoxia. So animals at high altitude are also exposed to what's called hypoxia or low oxygen.
Okay. So, yeah, I was going to ask you to define that.
Right. Hypoxia is low oxygen. And so at altitude, there's less oxygen. And so many animals at altitude have developed strategies to deal with low oxygen. And some of them have increased their hemoglobin concentrations, which we think will then relate to more CO. And it could be protective for those animals as well.
What is your next step in terms of testing species? Who's in your sights right now?
So with this grant that we got from NSF, there's 3 main goals of the grant. And the first goal is what you've already mentioned, which is a shotgun approach. We want to know who has high CO and why. And so that's why we're trying to work with as many people as possible to get samples from animals to figure out what's the distribution of carbon monoxide in different animals. It's not something typically studied. The second is we know the elephant seal has lots of carbon monoxide. And so we want to know why and how they produce it. So we're looking at mechanisms at how they produce carbon monoxide. One of those is going to be investigating red blood cell lifespan. That's never been measured in any marine mammal, so we'd be the first to do that. And then we're going to try to measure that in several different species.
Measuring red blood cell lifespan.
Yeah. So
do we know the lifespan of red blood cells in humans?
Yeah. So our red blood cell lifespan is about 100 to 120 days. And after that, your red blood cell breaks open and releases everything inside, which is mostly hemoglobin. And when you chop up the hemoglobin, you make the carbon monoxide. So we think that the elephant seals potentially have a different red blood cell lifespan that relates to higher CO production.
Meaning shorter?
Potentially shorter. That's my current hypothesis, but stay tuned.
We will. We absolutely will. What will the application be once we figure out what the lifespan is of the red blood cells for some of these other species? What will that mean for humans? How will that answer some of these questions that you're trying to ask about the application of carbon monoxide in medicine?
It's a great question. So the beauty of working with the elephant seal right now is even though they're large, they're relatively easy to work with. You can sedate them, you can take samples and so on and so forth. And they're in California, so it's not too hard to get to. They're the only animal right now with the Weddell seal known to have high amounts of CO. So all of these clinical studies that are showing where CO is protective is giving someone CO or increasing the levels of CO in someone that it's not normal for CO to be high. And so what we want to know is it's normal for CO to be high in an elephant seal. How does the elephant seal using the CO as a potential cytoprotective or protective advantage for their tissues? And so that's the next step is looking at CO and how the elephant seal is potentially using it for tissue protection.
You're listening to Coastline. UNCW comparative physiologist Michael Tift is with us today. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll learn about his quest to make science more accessible to non-scientists. It's also the last segment, so if you have a question about elephant seals or any other deep-diving mammals or reptiles, give us a call, 910-343-1138. On this Wednesday during the live edition, or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of the ability of deep-diving mammals such as elephant seals, dolphins, Cuvier-beaked whales, sperm whales, how they regulate their oxygen and carbon monoxide levels and stay underwater for extended periods. Michael Tift is a comparative physiologist and assistant professor in UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology. He also recently won a $1 million grant from the National Science Foundation to further his studies in this field, and he's with us during this live Wednesday discussion. You can ask your own question by either calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. You said that you studied hypoxia, and you've studied humans in high altitudes. What have you learned about humans in high altitudes, and how are they different from those of us closer to sea level?
So there's two populations that we've been interested in studying high altitude humans. When I was a postdoc at UC San Diego, I was working with Dr. Tatum Simonson, and she has done a lot of work in Tibet, working with people living at high altitude in Tibet. And when she was there, she looked at the genes of the people living in Tibet and showed that one of the genes was under positive selection, meaning that it is uniquely different in that population. And that gene was actually associated with carbon monoxide production. And so what's unique about Tibetans is that they do not typically have the blood response that you or I have and many individuals have when they go to or are exposed to hypoxia or low oxygen. If you and I go to high altitude, our body recognizes that we're experiencing low oxygen, and in order to try to help us, our body produces more red blood cells and more hemoglobin so that we can store more oxygen in this low oxygen environment.
When so our body does basically what elephant seals' bodies do. Our body tries to.
Right. It's trying to increase the ability for you to store more oxygen when we go to altitude. Tibetans, when they're exposed to hypoxia or low oxygen, they don't increase red blood cell production. And so they're very unique in that aspect. In fact, it's been shown that if you take a Tibetan and you essentially do like a blood doping experiment, they actually exercise and perform worse. So they're really unique in many aspects of hypoxia exposure. Now, if you go to South America and you go and you look at individuals living in the high altitude in the Andes, they respond very typical to hypoxia and low oxygen altitude in that they produce red blood cells to hypoxia, but they overproduce red blood cells in many cases. And when they overproduce red blood cells, their blood gets too thick. And your heart doesn't function well if it's pumping thick blood. And so they often have many issues associated with that. And so we think that this enzyme that is responsible for breaking down hemoglobin and making carbon monoxide is crucial to understand between these two populations. Because if you're breaking down red blood cells at a more rapid rate, which is potentially what's happening in Tibetans, you're not going to get the thick blood. And if you don't increase the rate of hemoglobin and red cell breakdown, which might be happening in Peruvians, you will develop thick blood.
And so Peruvians have higher instances of these health issues resulting from thick blood?
Yeah, that's correct. So, yeah, individuals living down in South America at high altitude have high instances of chronic mountain sickness, which is associated with that thick blood. And so it's actually a disease where, unfortunately, there's really only two treatment options for individuals that have chronic mountain sickness. One is moving down to low altitude, and if your family has been at high altitude for your entire life and many ancestors before you, it's a very sad thing to have to move away from all of that. The other is, unfortunately, consistent phlebotomies, which is getting blood drawn from yourself consistently in order to reduce the amount of red blood cells in you. So if we can work with those populations in order to figure out how to treat those conditions of high red blood cell count, thick blood, we really want to know how the Tibetans are handling hypoxia, if there's anything we can learn from them, as well as these elephant seals. Elephant seals have very thick blood, and many marine mammals have very thick blood, and they don't have any of the injuries associated with having thick blood. So there's another way that we can use animals, not necessarily from the carbon monoxide standpoint, but from the fact that they have thick blood and they tolerate it very well.
Do you have any theories as to why Peruvians would not have developed an ability to handle
hypoxia? My hypothesis for the Peruvians is that their body is responding to the low oxygen environment by increasing red blood cell production, and they probably aren't responding by increasing the destruction rate of the red cells. So if you increase the rate that you're producing red cells and you don't increase the rate you're destroying them, then you'll have a buildup of red cells and eventually you'll have thick blood, which is why they have to consistently get blood drawn from them in order to feel better with thinner blood.
So you said that some of the species that you're testing, like killer whales, for instance, that testing has to be done through a zoological organization. It has to be done with animals in captivity because it's impossible to get a sample from a wild animal. Does this completely fly in the face of scientific principle, tame a population of elephant seals that would still live in the wild that you could, you know, test, out with?
No, that's not necessary for the research that we're doing. The dolphins and the whales that we work with, right now it's impossible to get a blood sample from a free-ranging animal unless it's stranded on the beach. There are some researchers that can and bring small dolphins into boats to get a blood sample, but in general, like if you're looking at larger whales and dolphins, the only real opportunity to get a fresh blood sample, or sometimes we have to get a breath sample, where you actually have to have controlled breath samples where it's like a, for us, it would be like a CPR mask over our mouth and you exhale. You can only do that with a trained animal. With the elephant seals, there's really no need to bring animals into captivity for long periods of time because we've established techniques to work with them in the field. We can bring them back for short durations, but we always take them back to the beach where we got them from and release them.
What's the different information that you get from breath versus blood from these animals?
So the breath in your lung that comes from your lungs, right? That if you can get a breath sample where you exhale the most amount of air out of your lungs, that last little bit of air coming out of your lungs is the air that was most recently in contact with blood. And so it's a way to look at blood parameters without taking a blood sample. And so you can look at gases in the blood by getting that sample. And so we've actually worked with certain zoological organizations like SeaWorld to have the animals exhale forcefully and actually get those end-tidal breath samples. That's what it's called, the last little bit of breath from the lungs.
How do you do that? How do you get an animal to exhale forcefully?
So we train, we work with the trainers, and we tell them that we need the animals to exhale fully, and they slowly train the animals to recognize the device that we're going to be collecting the sample with. And then the trainers are amazing in what they're able to do, and they'll start off with small exhalations. And then the animals, when they by the time that we're ready to collect samples, the animals can see the instrument or the CPR looking mask device that we use, and they know what's going on, and then when they put it on the animal, they exhale fully.
Now, SeaWorld is phasing out of having killer whales in captivity. What will that do to your studies? And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but they're keeping the animals that they have in captivity but not taking any new animals in. So when the last captive killer whale dies, that'll be the end of their killer whale program.
Yeah, that's right. So my research focuses a lot on getting these blood samples and these controlled breath samples. So it's really advantageous for me to work with SeaWorld and the trained animals to be able to get these samples, since I can't collect them from wild animals. So I've had a very great relationship with SeaWorld in that they've worked really closely with me to train their animals in order to collect the samples that I need that I'm not able to obtain from wild animals.
Do you know when that's going to come to an end? I mean, what's the youngest killer whale that they have, and what's the lifespan?
I'm not sure, actually, when that's going to come to an end. I think it's constantly in flux. It changes. I know that they aren't breeding animals anymore, and they're not bringing any more in, but I'm not sure when it's going to end.
You're listening to Coastline. Deep-diving mammals such as elephant seals have an incredible ability to stay underwater for up to 2 hours at a time, and the discoveries that scientists are making about this ability may help human patients recover more quickly from heart attacks, strokes, even organ transplants. My guest today is Michael Tift. He's a comparative physiologist and assistant professor in UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology. Just a few minutes left to get your own question in during the live Wednesday discussion. You can either call us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. So two scientists walk into a bar. Tell me what that is, besides the lead into probably a very bad joke.
All right. So the Fleet Science Center in San Diego had a very great outreach program. And so while I was going and doing my doctorate and my postdoctorate in San Diego at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and UC San Diego Medical School, they had a program called Two Scientists Walk Into a Bar. And the idea behind it was to take two scientists and to put them in lab coats and to take them to a local bar or a brewery. And they'd put up a sign next to the scientist that said, "Two scientists walk into a bar. We're scientists. Come ask us anything." The idea was that some of the general public are intimidated to ask a scientist a question, even if it's something they've thought about for a long time. And so what we wanted to do, we're working with the Fleet Science Center, was basically put ourselves out there as scientists in lab coats and say, come ask us anything.
So were you one of the guys?
Yeah, so I was one of the first to do the project, and then I did it several times after because it was so much fun.
What kind of questions did you get?
And so you would have...
And were you allowed to have a beer along with the people who asked you questions?
Of course, that's part of the perk of the whole thing.
Of course.
Yeah, so, you'd have different... different types of questions. You'd have some people that were on their phones trying to find the hardest scientific questions, like, is there actually a center of the universe? Which we could easily say, oh, that's a good question. I don't think we know. But, you know, I actually work with deep diving animals. You ever have any questions about that? And kind of turn it around just to have get a conversation going. And then you'd actually have someone, you know, come up and be like, oh, I think this is really neat. You know, what do you study? And then they would have conversations, and it could go on for an hour or two. It was a lot of fun.
What were some of the most memorable questions that you got that you just thought, oh, this makes it worth it, and I want to do more to get science out to non-scientists?
Yeah, I think some of the best questions that I got were people that were generally concerned with large topic questions such as, climate change, vaccines, things like that. And we can kind of give our insight or our opinion on what we think and kind of some of the data and the research to support it. I feel like those are some of the biggest concerns among scientists today, is where we have conclusion on some big topics, but the general public still might not agree or understand. And so I feel like getting involved in programs like Two Scientists Walk in a Bar and other closely related programs that San Diego and many other cities have, it's very important for scientists to be able to break down what they do and confer that to the public in a basically easy to understand way, because it's very easy to make a topic complicated. It's very difficult to make it easy to understand. And I think that is what a lot of scientists need to practice, is taking their research and other aspects of closely related research and being able to just lay it out there as simply as possible.
Other than being able to promote your work for the purpose of getting grants, why? I mean, there are obvious elements of this, like climate change. If people don't believe the scientific consensus around that, then they'll be less inclined to actually want to do something about it. And the survival of the planet really depends on whether humans start to care about that. Whether vaccines cause autism. I mean, that's another issue on which the scientific community has come out pretty conclusively, like, no, there's no
Very
link.
Very conclusively.
Yes. So that's easy to understand. But when you're talking about, for instance, the physiology of deep diving mammals or mm-hmm. deep diving reptiles and the applications to human and veterinary medicine, why do you think people need to know about that?
So different fields of medicine always have new discoveries that lead to new treatments, right? And so sometimes it takes a big leap to make a new discovery, right? And it could be discovering something as unique as carbon monoxide in deep diving animals. And so where my research is heading right now in our lab is looking at animals that are the only animals currently known to produce this gas, and seeing if it's protective and how it protects them, because other researchers are showing that it is protective in human patients and in laboratory clinical studies. So what we try to do as comparative physiologists is find these kind of unique animals that have these unique physiologies and try to relate them to different systems and figure out how they work. Like, for instance, the blood flow in the body was very poorly understood until about the 1600s, when someone actually started looking at blood flow in a snake. And they would reduce blood flow to the upper part of the snake and figure out how blood flowed through the heart, and then they reduce blood flow in the lower half of the snake. And it was the first time that they actually conclusively showed that blood flows out of the heart to the body and then back to the heart. Before then, they didn't really know how blood flow worked. And so working with animals is a great way to look at differences in physiology and how the body works.
And I think it matters that the guy who's going to do his work tonight, you know, whether he's driving a UPS truck or teaching a class of second graders mm-hmm. or, you know, picking up recycling today, goes to the bar and has a beer. I think it's important that he understands some of this stuff. But why do you think it's important? Why does it matter to him? I mean, of course, it matters to the medical doctor and the pharmaceutical researcher and scientists like you who help to make those links between disciplines. But why do you think it should matter to that other guy who has nothing to do with this?
Well, I think it's important for the general public to be able to ask scientists questions. You know, I just got funded a large grant to study carbon monoxide, and that was mostly through NSF, which is taxpayer dollars. And I think that the general public should be able to ask scientists questions. And as scientists, we should become better at learning how to address those questions, whether it be elephant seals and carbon monoxide or whether it be climate change.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Michael Tift, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline producer is Caitlin Freund. News producer is Rachel Keith. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.